case had gone off the rails. As far as Dom was concerned, Albright needed some help, despite what Albright might have thought of the situation. He called David at 8 a.m. "Did you hear about the murder of Eve Pang?"
"Yes, and the disappearance of the two FBI men along with Ethan Ross. All very unfortunate."
"Yeah.
I am assuming this is the man you told me about yesterday. The person whose name you would not give us."
"One and the same. We might have been able to help. Our sources say there are no leads as of yet."
"I'm hearing the same thing," said Dom. "Assuming this was not some random act of DC crime that the FBI men stumbled into, we have to wonder who else would be so interested in Ross and what he knows that they would take such steps to keep him out of the hands of the American authorities."
Dom said, "If we find out where he went, I suspect we'll have the answer to that question."
"Any progress on that end?" David asked, hopefully.
"I'm not in the investigation. Albright has pushed me away. I can only assume they are tracking his mobile phone and know where he went." David hesitated, then said,
"His phone hasn't left his home.
I'm sure the FBI knows that already."
Dom asked, "How the hell do you know that?"
"We have some ability to look into the cell phone company's records." "Is this where you tell me Israeli intelligence has hacked into a U.S. business?"
"I'm not telling you anything of the sort."
"Right." David was going to be coy about the specifics of Mossad's capabilities, and Dom knew to let it go. At least the Mossad man was talking to him. David continued. "Anyway, his phone is still sending a signal to the mobile tower closest to his house."
Dom rushed over to his laptop and opened it. "I've got the SIM card number from a secondary phone he was using. He might have that one on him. Can you track it via the number?"
"I don't know, but I can find out. Have you given this to the FBI?"
"No. That would involve some questions I don't want to answer."
"Ah, I understand completely. I'll look into this and call you when I have something."
David called Dom less than an hour later, and the Mossad officer asked Dom for a person-to-person meet at 10 a.m.
30. The Beechcraft King Air landed in Bocas del Toro International Airport just after 9 a.m., and it took all Ethan's self-control to keep from pushing past the others to get out of the tight confines of the little cabin and into the open air. Once out onto the hot and humid tarmac, however, he realized he had been more comfortable inside the plane's climate-controlled cabin. The airstrip was located on the tiny island of Colón, and Ethan had seen on the flight in that the island was part of an archipelago, surrounded on all sides by a multitude of larger islands and keys. All of them were flat and overgrown with tropical vegetation, but Colón Airport was surrounded by the ramshackle Bocas town, with houses and businesses standing just 50 feet on either side of the runway, past overgrown grasses and brush that ran along the airport property's fence line. Palm trees blew in the hot breeze, and the smell of gasoline and jungle filled the American's nostrils. The Beechcraft was met on the already hot tarmac by a 12-passenger van, crewed by a pair of big, severe-faced Latin men Ethan assumed were more Venezuelan intelligence agents. The small amount of luggage from the King Air was transferred to the van, and everyone boarded for the 10-minute drive through dirty and congested third-world streets to the docks. Except for Arturo. He climbed back aboard the aircraft, intending to continue on to Caracas to help organize the roundup of American spies. As the van motored through the little town, it was explained to the three non-Venezuelans in the van, Ross, Bertoli, and Mohammed, that the safe house was on the nearby larger but more remote island of Bastimentos. They passed a few police cars and even a truck full of soldiers from the Panamanian public forces. This unnerved Ethan, but he recognized he could do little but sit patiently and hope the Venezuelans knew what the hell they were doing. So he just continued looking out the window. At the docks, he saw all manner of boats doing a steady business moving people and products between the neighboring islands and keys. But his sizable entourage walked past the ferry boats and water taxis and instead boarded two large speedboats. Almost immediately, they headed off to the southeast over choppy water. They passed just south of Carenero Key, then turned to bisect a transportation lane full of ferry and cargo traffic, before finally motoring into the calmer waters between Solarte Island and Bastimentos Island. At first, Ethan thought Bastimentos looked completely uninhabited, but as they neared the shore and trolled along it to the south, every few hundred yards he could pick out the metal roof of a building sticking up from the thick jungle. Within minutes, the two boats turned into an inlet and began cruising very slowly. On their left was thick mangrove, but on their right a yellow sandy beach came out of the water and continued into thick palms. As they rounded a bend in the inlet, Ethan expected to see a dilapidated tin shack of some sort, but instead a large white colonial home appeared, surrounded by a huge manicured lawn, some 25 yards back from the shoreline. The two-story building had a wraparound veranda on the second floor, and Ethan saw several men standing there, looking down at the approaching boats. Around the main building, the neat green lawn ran all the way to the sandy water's edge and the jungle on either side of it. A bald-headed man with a bushy mustache and a tropic-weight suit stood on the dock, waiting for the boats. His smile was wide and inviting, but on either side of him, younger, tougher-looking men stood with sidearms on their hips. In English, he said, "My friends, welcome." Ethan climbed out of the boat ahead of Bertoli and Mohammed, and he shook the bald-headed man's hand. "My name is Leopoldo. Please call me Leo." "Ethan Ross." "Bienvenido a Panama, Señor Ross." He shook hands with the other two visitors, and the four of them began walking up the steps to the main house. "What is this place?" Ross asked. Leo grinned proudly. "We think of it as a home away from home. Originally, this was the residence of a French businessman in the fruit industry, about 100 years ago. Then, for many years, it was a luxury hotel. A friend of the Venezuelan government bought it several years back, and he loans it to us when we need it." Leo was obviously proud of this place. "All the comforts of home. Satellite TV and phones, good internet. We even have our own chef." He patted Ethan on his back as if they were old friends. "You all will be very well taken care of, and I am personally at your service." Mohammed interrupted, but softly and apologetically. "Excuse me, sir. What can you tell us about the security of this location?" Leo opened his jacket, revealing an MP5 machine pistol. "Don't worry, my friends. 10 men are dedicated to security here at the compound. 5 more of us are also armed and trained. Panamanian police have a gunboat that patrols around here, and they watch out for us as well." Mohammed pressed Leo on the plan. "What if we are somehow discovered by the Americans? How do we get out of here?" "The boats, of course. Plus there are a couple of trucks in the driveway, always ready for escape. This island is over 50 square kilometers in size, with dirt roads in the jungle. And there are docks on all sides with more boats. There are many ways to get away from here if we need to do so, but nobody can sneak up on us without us knowing about it." "Thank you," said Mohammed. Ethan found it surprising that the young Lebanese man had the nerve to question the Venezuelan's operation, but Leo didn't seem offended in the least. The colonial house was large, with a massive 2-story great room and several common areas on the ground floor, and 8 bedrooms on the second floor. Several outbuildings sat around a dirty swimming pool and a cracked tennis court and provided more shelter for the guard force of the safe house. Ethan was given a room in the northeastern corner of the second floor, and an armed but professional-looking silver-haired security man was posted outside. There was no access to the wraparound veranda from Ethan's room, but through the window he saw monkeys climbing in the trees outside. He felt protected, more or less, but he was no fool. Despite the assurances of the Venezuelans, he knew if the Americans or the Israelis came for him here, his only chance would be to run for his life.
31. Georgetown Neighborhood Library was a beautiful colonial building in one of the most upscale quarters of Washington, D.C., but it smelled, quite literally, like shit. A homeless man who slept the day away on one of the comfortable chairs had shat himself, and the odor wafted through every inch of the ground floor of the historic building. The employees, by now quite accustomed to the homeless in their midst, had developed the ability to ignore the smell, but the well-dressed gentleman looking through the racks of the history section could not hide his expression of extreme displeasure. Dominic Caruso appeared at his side. "You okay?" "Fine," David said, lying through his clenched teeth. "Shall we go upstairs and try to get away from the unpleasant smell?" David led the way up two flights, and they found a quiet corner in the third floor Peabody room that was both secluded and odor-free.
"Much better," David said. "I brought news for you. It is only for you. As far as I know, no one in your government is aware of this right now."
"Keep talking."
"We were able to geolocate the SIM card you gave us, and we found the phone."
Dom winced. "Let me guess. It wasn't with Ethan Ross."
"I am afraid not.
The phone was in a dumpster behind a 7-Eleven in Reston, Virginia."
"Damn it." "Dead end, then."
"Not at all. We got a look at the security camera feed inside the 7-Eleven that corresponded with the time the phone was dumped."
Dominic leaned against the rack of books, crossing his arms.
"And how the hell did you manage that?"
David smiled.
"We've been through this before. Our relationship requires trust, Mr. Caruso, and it requires taking things on faith."
"Right.
On the camera, we saw Ethan Ross enter the store alone and purchase a mobile phone. We figure he tossed his 3-day-old phone in the dumpster, then went and grabbed an even fresher one. We used the transaction details from the register to find the barcode information from the packaging of the phone. From this, we..."
Dom held up a hand now.
"Wait, what? The Mossad can hack into a 7-Eleven's point-of-sale system?"
David raised his eyebrows, but said nothing.
"Okay, I'll stop asking questions."
The Mossad officer went on.
"From the barcode, we were able to pull the SIM number from the phone, and we geolocated it to Dulles Airport. Apparently, he took the battery out. But in Dulles, he put the battery back in. We got a hit, then he removed the battery again, and we lost the ping. At first, that looked like another dead end, but on closer inspection, the phone did not go to the main terminal. Instead, it pinged from a charter hangar. There was one charter that left around the time the phone was at Dulles."
"Where did it go?"
"Miami. And then from there it filed a flight plan to Caracas, Venezuela."
"Caracas?" Dom repeated. "Do you know who chartered the flight?"
"Yes. A front company for Venezuela's General Intelligence Service."
Dom scratched his head, utterly confused now.
"Ross is a Middle East expert who gave away secrets that benefited the Palestinians. What the hell does any of this have to do with the Venezuelan government? We do not know. But there is another problem. We had people waiting in Caracas for the flight to land, but the aircraft changed the flight plan in the air and went to Panama. Dom leaned his head back against a bookshelf. From Panama City, they could get on a flight to anywhere. They did not go to Panama City. They went to Bocas del Toro, in the north of the country, a small airport on Isla Colón. They should have landed in the past hour. We weren't able to get anyone to the airport fast enough to look for them. Any idea why they flew to Bocas del Toro? None. Dom thought it over. The Panamanian government and the Venezuelan government were not exactly engaged in a shooting war, but the two nations did have an adversarial relationship. Dom could imagine no reason Venezuelan intelligence would sneak an American spy out of the United States and drop him off in the middle of the Panamanian jungle. Dom left the library with a promise to call David soon. Neither of the men knew what their next step would be in the Ethan Ross hunt, but Dom knew where he would find more information. As he walked back to his motorcycle in the lot behind the library, he called Jerry Hendley and asked him if he could find out what the CIA knew about Venezuelan operations in Bocas del Toro, Panama. Jerry was quite understandably confused by the request, but he promised to call one of his contacts on the 7th floor of Langley and get right back to him. 30 minutes later, Dom was back in his Lincoln Circle condo when his phone chirped. He saw it was Hendley on the other end. "Tell me you've got something, Jerry." Jerry spoke in his characteristic southern drawl. "I've got something, but I have no idea what good it will do you. My contacts at CIA gave me 3 locations in Bocas del Toro they say have been pegged in some shape or form to the Venezuelan security services. That's GIO, the General Intelligence Office, and GCIO, General Counterintelligence Office. Let me have them. There is a hotel in Bocas Town that was bought by a couple of ex-GIO boys from Caracas a few months back. I've got the address. In the town itself? No, that doesn't sound like what I'm looking for. What else? A pilot for a puddle jumper service at the airport has been identified as a Venezuelan asset. Damn, Dom said. He thought it possible Ross was put on yet another airplane in Bocas and flown somewhere even more remote than Bocas del Toro. But the more he thought of it, the less it rang true. They were flying in a King Air 350i, an airplane that didn't need a particularly long field for landing. They wouldn't have to change planes to go to a remote airport. Dom said, "What's the third lead?" "For the third, they couldn't give me an address. They gave me the longitude and latitude. Apparently, it's a large old colonial building on a tropical island a few miles boat ride from Bocas del Toro itself. It's owned by a family tied to the Bolivarian government in power in Caracas." Dom knew instantly this lead was a much better prospect than the first two. "Give me the coordinates." Jerry did so, and Dom typed them into Eagle View on his laptop. Looking over the satellite map of the property, he thought it could possibly be used as a safe house for the Venezuelan security services. It was secluded, with good views of both a narrow inlet and a dirt road that headed to the southern part of the island. "Yeah," he muttered to himself. Then Dom said, "Jerry, sorry, but I need to call you right back." Dom dialed David and checked his watch while the phone rang. As soon as the other man answered, the American said, "I think I know where Ross is."
"Where?"
"Before I tell you, I want assurances you won't get in my way. You offered me logistical help. That's what I want."
"Agreed."
"He's going to be in a safe house run by Venezuelan intelligence on a tropical island near Bocas del Toro, Panama."
"I see.
Do you have any idea what he is doing there?"
"None at all.
I'm speculating, but perhaps he gave the Venezuelans some intelligence in exchange for safe passage out of the country. I don't know what intelligence, nor do I know why they wouldn't just take him directly to Caracas.
But you want to go down there to look for him?
Alone? Yes.
What is it you hope to accomplish?
I'm going to get proof he's there, and get some intel on the location.
And then?
And then maybe you can send a team of Shayatet 13 commandos to kill him. It's Panama, it's not D.C. Surely you won't have any qualms about smoking this guy on a jungle island in Central America for what he did to the Yacobies. David replied coldly,
We would do it with great pleasure.
But David, just so there is no misunderstanding, if I get down there and happen to find an opportunity, I'm going to kill him myself.
Even better, David replied. What do you need from me?
Guns. In Bocas, waiting for me when I get there. David whistled.
Our operation in Panama is very limited, but I'll see what I can do.
Dom redialed Jerry Hendley next, and greeted him with a request that did not take the ex-South Carolina senator completely by surprise. I would like to ask permission to leave the country for a few days.
Let me guess. You want to go to Panama?
Good guess. The reason for this impromptu vacation? Venezuelan intelligence has Ethan Ross. This has been established by my contact in the Mossad. They took him there to Bocas, likely to that colonial building in the jungle. Jerry said, If the Venezuelans have him, why the hell isn't he in Venezuela?
That's the question of the hour.
Haven't figured that out yet. What do you plan on doing once you get there?
I plan on evaluating the security situation around him,
and then liaising with Mossad.
Why don't you communicate what you know with the FBI?
Right now it's less what I know and more what I think I know. I can't prove anything yet. Dom hadn't said anything about either taking a shot at Ross himself or arranging for Israeli special forces to do the hit, but Jerry was no fool, and he knew what his man had been going through since India. He filled in the blanks and said,
You know, killing Ross won't bring the Yacobies back. What you were planning is simple vengeance, nothing more.
Dom said, I know. After a moment, Jerry sighed.
Fair enough. You understand this operation you were undertaking is in no way sanctioned by the campus or the United States government.
Dom wanted to say, that's the whole idea, but instead he just said, I do.
Having said that, I'm not letting you go down there without support. What do you need from me?
I appreciate it, but I'm not going to expose our operation in this endeavor. I'll get the support I need. Before Jerry could respond, there was a loud banging at the door that even Jerry heard over the phone. Dom looked up quickly. Then his eyes narrowed. He said, On the topic of assistance, have you been sending Adara Sherman to check up on me?
Is there any point in me denying it?
I was hoping it was the fact she'd finally noticed my good looks and charm. Jerry chuckled.
Nope. In fact, it's the opposite. She told me you looked like hell and were acting even darker and more brooding than usual, which for you is saying something. So I've asked her to watch over you.
A pause.
I guess if you've been out running around with foreign agents on a one-man vengeance mission, she hasn't done a terribly good job.
She's done fine. I've been working full-time to avoid her. She's here now. Dom looked at the door suddenly.
Jerry, I need to call you back again.
Jerry seemed surprised, but he recovered quickly.
Sure. All right. Stay in touch.
Dom opened the door,
Adara stood in front of him, wearing blue jeans, winter boots, and a thick coat. Her blonde hair was hidden under a knit cap, but the cap did nothing to hide the perturbed expression on her face.
"You do realize, Caruso, that I've got other things I could be doing with my time."
"Of course. Come on in." She entered, looked around at Dom's messy condo, and then opened his refrigerator like she owned the place. It was all but empty, as were the cupboards she checked. She lifted a bottle of Maker's Mark off the kitchen table and saw that it was almost empty. She turned back to Dom and gave him a disapproving look. She said, "I'm going to clean up around here, and then I'm going shopping. You need some food, some real food. You're going to bitch about it, but it's going to happen anyway, so you might as well go somewhere and mope while I do what I'm going to do."
Dom shook his head vehemently. "Appreciated, but not necessary, Sherman. I'm actually going out of town, today. I promise I'll call you when I get back in town."
Adara Sherman did not bat an eye.
"Actually, that won't be necessary."
Dom's eyebrows rose. Maybe these wellness checks were finally over.
"Really?
Why not?"
"Because I'm going with you."
"No. This is Okonis, outside the continental United States."
She sighed, annoyed. "You don't think I know what Okonis means?"
Dom fought a groan. He didn't have time for this. He needed to get on a plane ASAP.
"Look, this will be a recon op, okayed by Jerry, but not exactly sanctioned, and very possibly dangerous. I'm sorry, but I can't take responsibility for you."
"Of course you can't. I'm worried you can't take responsibility for yourself, so I'm going along to watch over you."
Dom started to protest some more, but he stopped himself.
"Hang on a second. Do you know anything about boats?"
She rolled her eyes.
"I was in the Navy, Caruso."
"I don't mean battleships. I mean something small. Fast enough on open water, but something that won't stick out."
Sherman said, "Two things. One, the U.S. Navy doesn't have battleships anymore. And two, where would this boat be operating and what would it be transporting?"
"An archipelago in Panama, and I need it to transport me and some scuba gear."
"That's it?"
After a shrug, Dom said, "Maybe a gun."
The attractive blonde did not hesitate.
"Okay. You'll want a shallow draft, something small, 20 to 30 feet long, I'd say. Maybe a ski boat. Mastercraft makes some great ones I'm very familiar with. Of course, it all depends on what's available down there."
Dom had already returned to his computer, and now he was pulling up flights for today.
"Okay, you win. You can come along. Go home and pack a bag, then meet me at Dulles in an hour. There's a 1 p.m. flight. If you haul ass, we can just make it and be in Panama City by 5. We can find air transport to Bocas del Toro when we get there."
Adara didn't move.
"My passport is in my purse, and I have a 3-day carry-on in the trunk of my car. Part of working for Jerry Hendley. On call 24/7. I can buy anything else I need en route or once there."
Dom was duly impressed. Even he and the other operators of the campus bitched if they didn't get at least a couple hours prep time before traveling Okonis.
"There's just one problem," Sherman added. "You have dark hair, dark eyes, tan skin. You can fit in down in Panama as long as you don't open your mouth. I, on the other hand, have short blonde hair and gray eyes. I'd fit in better on the moon than in Central America."
Dom laughed.
"You'll be my hot but overly controlling girlfriend. Trust me, Sherman, nobody who meets you is going to second-guess that cover story for a second."
"Not after I give you a black eye, they won't."
32. Gianna, Ethan, and Mohammed lunched at a table set up by the poorly maintained swimming pool in the back of the large colonial home. Guards wandered the property or watched over them from the veranda. All three ate grilled sea bass, and Gianna and Ethan drank Chilean Pinot Grigio, while Mohammed sipped orange juice.
He remained glued to his laptop, though Ethan had no idea what the young man could possibly be working on. The Venezuelan intelligence officer Leo had spent the entire morning since their arrival with his guests, but just before lunch he retreated for a conference call with Caracas. Between healthy sips of wine, Ethan asked, "What's the next step?"
"Harland and I will connect via CryptoCat this afternoon. He's reaching out to his sources to see what is known in the FBI investigation into Eve's death."
"That's it?"
"Really. For right now, there is little more for us to do but wait and try to relax."
Ethan was not going to relax. This he knew for certain. He'd topped off his glass of wine, ignoring Bertoli's. Gianna said, "There is some news out of Washington. As I was dressing for lunch in my room, I watched CNN. I can't see how it is related to your case, but it is very distressing nonetheless."
"What is it?"
"The bodies of two FBI employees were found floating in the Potomac River." Ethan's eyes widened in shock.
"Wait. They can't think I had anything to do with it, can they?"
Mohammed just took a sip of orange juice. Bertoli said, "I don't imagine they really think it, but I can't say they won't use it. It's bad timing. I know how the Americans operate. They will be looking for other crimes to charge you with. Maybe these two men died in a robbery or something, and they want to blame you. Maybe there are no dead men, and this is all some ploy to charge you with a murder."
Mohammed spoke without looking up. "Murder of a federal law enforcement officer in America is punishable by death."
Ethan put his head down on the table. Bertoli rubbed the back of his neck while Mohammed calmly picked up his knife and cut into his sea bass. Dom and Adara flew a Copa Airlines flight out of Dulles at 1 p.m., and they worked quietly together on their surveillance plan during the entire 5-hour flight down. They made a list of gear they would need to find, and they passed an iPad back and forth with an Eagle View map of the area. They landed in Panama City and immediately climbed aboard an Air Panama Fokker 50 that would take them to Bocas del Toro. The 50-seater was filled with locals, mostly, but a few tourists were on the flight as well, so Sherman didn't feel like she stuck out too much. They touched down on the hot runway at Bocas del Toro Isla Colón International Airport a little after 6:30 p.m. As they stepped off the plane and onto the broken tarmac of the little airfield, Dominic shouldered his backpack. Adara did the same with her pack. Then she reached out and took Dom's hand and held it as they walked toward the tiny terminal building. Dom didn't make a comment about this, but just before they passed through the door toward the cab stand, Adara leaned close to him. "Couple of guys standing around the terminal who might be spotters. Can't be too careful."
"No, you sure can't."
He put his arm around her and led her toward a waiting taxi. Their hotel was the aptly named Hotel Bocas del Toro. It was positioned on the eastern tip of the island in the heart of downtown Bocas, so close to the shore a portion of the 3-story colonial-style building actually hung over the water. Dom and Adara took a room on the 3rd floor that faced Carnero Key, an impossibly green slice of land sticking out of impossibly blue water with rusty tin roofs sticking out of the trees. They dropped their bags on a table and looked around at the small room. Neither made mention of the one bed as they headed out to the balcony and surveyed the neighborhood from the 3rd floor. Once outside, Adara leaned toward Dom, so quickly it startled him and so closely he thought she was going to kiss him. Instead, she said, "Should we assume we're being listened to?" Dom cracked a little smile. "No, not here. We're okay. Jerry told all of us in the flight crew that when we were working, we should assume every hotel is bugged and to act accordingly."
"The only bugs in this place are the centipedes on the wall."
Sherman turned and looked at the wall just inches behind her. A prehistoric-looking insect the length of a magic marker crawled along next to the French doors between the balcony and the room. Adara turned her nose up a little, but otherwise ignored it. Dom said, "Aren't you supposed to freak out or something?" "Because I'm female?" Not only did Dom not answer, but he regretted asking the question in the first place. Adara said, "I was in Afghanistan. We had camel spiders the size of dinner plates climbing around our latrine. Bugs don't faze me." "Then this place is gonna feel like the Ritz." Dominic called David on his satellite phone, and the Mossad officer passed on an address on the far side of Cologne Island and told Dom he had a meeting there with a local Mossad contact, but not until 11 p.m. As soon as the call ended, Dom and Adara went downstairs and headed to the nearby docks. Here they split up. Adara's job was to find a boat available for rent, and Dom's task was to purchase the scuba gear and other equipment he would need for his surveillance tomorrow. Dom walked into and then back out of two dive shops. At the first one, they didn't have any equipment of the quality he required, and at the second, he did find top-of-the-line equipment that would suit his needs, but there was a significant problem. The buoyancy control device, the vest a diver wears that holds his tank and other equipment and helps control his buoyancy in the water, came only in red or bright purple. Dom was no slave to fashion, but he suspected swimming into harm's way wearing a big, brightly colored vest might not afford him the low-profile infiltration he was looking for. The third dive shop, however, had exactly what he needed. He rented a pair of full oxygen tanks, a 3mm neoprene wetsuit, a black BCD, a weight belt, a regulator, fins, a mask, and a dive knife with an ankle sheath. He paid an extra $50 in U.S. currency to have the equipment delivered to his hotel, and then he went off in search of other gear. He found a little camping store that catered to sea kayakers who set up camps on the beaches of the little uninhabited islands around the archipelago, and here he bought a canteen, rope, a waterproof backpack, plastic bags, binoculars, and a dozen other odds and ends that he thought might come in handy while he did surveillance on the potential Venezuelan safehouse. When Dom had everything he needed, all packed in the waterproof backpack, he returned to the hotel. Adara was already sitting on the balcony with a cold Balboa beer in her hand, studying nautical charts of the area she'd bought at the boat rental shop. Dom looked over the maps. To him it looked like a complicated mess of channels and splotchy, misshapen spits of land, all crisscrossed with lines and numbers. "Can you read that?" "Child's play," she said as she motioned to a cooler on the balcony. Dom pulled another beer out and sat down next to her. "Want to see the boat?" she asked. "You got us a boat already?" "I can do more than pass out peanuts on a plane, you know." "I do know. Where is it?" "Look down. Black hull, white body." Dom looked off the balcony and saw the boat bobbing in a slip along the hotel dock 3 stories below. It was a Mastercraft Maristar 235. It was not large at 25 feet, but big enough for the two of them and all the gear, and the perfect size for going into the inlets around the Venezuelan safehouse if they needed to. "Is it fast?" Dom asked. Adara didn't look up from the charts. "Those are 350-horsepower engines. They'll put out enough power for our needs. It's a ski boat, so it won't win any races with a real speedboat, but it won't stick out either. I've seen a half dozen just like it in the water around here in the past hour." Dom nodded in approval, and then the two of them began looking over the charts together to start working on an infiltration plan. With a few hours to kill before their 11 p.m. meeting with David's local Mossad contact, the two Americans walked down to a restaurant on the water to grab dinner. It was a slow night at the Ultimo Refugio, and they found a secluded table on the open back deck. They both ordered beers and fried fish, and for the first half hour they did their best to keep the conversation off the operation that would commence at first light tomorrow. Finally, Adara said, This is going to sound like a cliché to say this, but someone needs to say it to you because I don't think you're going to figure it out on your own. Killing this guy won't bring that family in India back. Dom nodded. I've been told. But you'll do it anyway. If I can. Adara sipped her beer slowly. Dom could see she wanted to say something, but she was trying to decide if it would be her place to do so. What?
You have survivor's guilt. About the Yacobees. And about Brian.
Dom shook his head. No, I don't. I know I did my best, both in India and in Libya.
It doesn't have anything to do with what you did. It has to do with the randomness of it all. The fact you survived an incident and others didn't.
She looked at him.
Your brother. The Yacobi children.
Survivor's guilt. Dom said it softly. Makes me sound like a head case.
You're not crazy. It's perfectly natural. You don't understand why you are here and they aren't. You think it's unfair that you won the roll of the dice.
Yes. Dom realized this was exactly what he had been thinking ever since Brian was killed. The feelings had subsided a little in the past 2 years, but after India they had come back twice as hard. Are you a shrink, too, Sherman? She shook her head with a smile.
No, not at all.
Then how are you able to diagnose me?
Because I have the same thing, and I've had it longer than you.
Something happened over there in Afghanistan? When you were a corpsman? She nodded.
A lot of somethings.
Before Dom could ask anything else, she said,
Can we just leave it at that?
Yeah. Sure, I understand. There was uncomfortable silence between them for a few minutes. Both ordered more drinks. Dom asked, How did you get linked up with the campus?
A patient.
A patient?
A young O-1.
What's an O-1?
Sorry, a Marine second lieutenant.
I was a Navy corpsman assigned to a Marine Combat Engineer Battalion in the Korangal Valley. An O-1 from a rifle platoon nearby took an AK round to the head. I was the first corpsman to him.
He was bleeding out, and I managed to stop the bleeding.
Dominic tipped his glass to her. Good for you. You saved his life. Adara looked away, out at the placid water. The sunset was behind them, but the channel glowed from the last rays of the day.
No. No happy ending, I'm afraid. He made it back stateside, but he died anyway.
Shit. I'm sorry. What did he have to do with the campus?
The lieutenant's dad was a colonel. He sent me an email a month or so after his son died. Told me how grateful he was that his boy had been able to come home and die among his family.
She smiled, still looking at the moonlit channel.
I guess if you look hard enough, you can find a silver lining in almost everything. Anyway, we stayed in touch over the years. He retired and went to work for MITRE Corps on a top-secret government contract. When I got out of the Navy, he offered me a job. I was going to go to nursing school, but his offer was pretty good. I got vetted, got my top-secret clearance, and then he took me to Maryland and introduced me to Jerry Hendley. The job was working on the Hendley Associates aircraft.
Do you regret not going to nursing school?
I'll still go, one day.
Besides, she smiled at Dom across the table.
You and the other guys are giving me a lot of real-world practical training. Every one of you has managed to get hurt.
Dom chuckled. It's the only way you'll give us any attention. It was a joke, but Adara gave him a serious look.
Do me a favor. Try not to get hurt down here.
An unfriendly parrot perched on the railing next to their table. Adara fed the bird a couple pieces of fish, but that only made it more annoying, so Dom shooed the bird away.
I'll do my best. And I promise I'll keep you out of danger.
Dom ordered a third round.
Are you trying to get me drunk?
I'm trying to get me drunk. You are just collateral damage.
Adara tipped her little glass to Caruso.
That's a great line. Does that work on the girls around D.C.?
Dom chugged his beer.
Not really.
If you have a hangover in the morning, it's going to make your job a lot harder.
Dom said, four beers isn't going to kick my ass.
Four?
They'd had only three. Dom looked at his watch.
We have time.
33. Just before 11 p.m., a belching taxi took them through Bocas Town, past rusty tin-roofed shacks and beat-up but brightly painted Victorian and colonial buildings. Street vendors selling handmade junk appeared at the windows of the taxi, no doubt triggered by Adara Sherman's shock of blonde hair that announced the presence of a tourist. The taxi dropped them off at an address David had provided earlier, on the northwestern edge of the town, and the two Americans stood alone in the street in front of a small supermarket for a few minutes, unsure if they should go in or wait outside. Before they could decide, an old two-door hatchback parked in an alley across the street flashed its lights, and after a look between them, Dom and Adara began walking toward it. A woman in her 40s climbed out from behind the wheel as the Americans approached. She introduced herself only as Maria. Dom and Adara shook her hand, but they offered no introductions at all. Dom was on guard. He looked around the alley, deciding it was secluded enough for a clandestine transaction such as this, but it was hardly a safe place to hang out for very long. He had the titanium diving knife strapped to his calf, but otherwise he was unarmed. This woman looked incredibly nervous, and that, along with the unsecure location, made Dom more than a little edgy himself. Maria lit a cigarette, then offered one to the two Americans, who both declined. She said,
I'm sorry, I'm a little tense. I got the call this afternoon. Normally when they need something. Well, it's been years since they've needed something, and it wasn't anything like this.
Adara Sherman was confused, but Dom understood. You are Sayan, right?
Yes, of course. You don't think I do this sort of thing for a living, do you?
Sayan were volunteers for Mossad, local assistants, not formal employees of the organization, but Jews living around the world ready to be called upon to perform duties on behalf of the Israeli spy service. Sayan could be doctors or shopkeepers or travel agents or truck drivers. They were normally people motivated by their duty to the nation of Israel.
Dom recognized that her anxious mannerisms were due to the fact she'd probably been pulled off her job as a lawyer or a town administrator or something similar, and then sent out to procure weapons for a couple of foreign operatives. Looking at her in this light, Dom decided her anxiety was perfectly reasonable.
Adara said, "Don't worry, Maria. You're doing great. We appreciate your help." Dom tried to get the meeting back on track. He didn't want to stand here in this dark lot any longer than he had to.
You brought some things for us?
She lifted the hatchback, revealing a large external frame backpack. Dom opened it and pulled out a beat-up-looking M9 Beretta pistol, U.S. Army issue, and an M16 rifle that had been partially disassembled to fit inside. The rifle was U.S. military issue as well, but Dom could tell it was very old. The military didn't use this version of the M16 any longer, and hadn't in years.
Did you get these guns from a museum?
Maria smoked nervously behind him.
The request was highly unusual. I did my best. We are a little island. Not many opportunities to...
Adara said, these will be just fine. What about ammunition? Maria cocked her head.
The bullets are already in the guns.
Adara looked at Dom, then asked, "Spare ammunition?"
"What? I'm sorry. that was not specified. As I said, it wasn't easy getting these guns.
Dom checked the magazines in the weapons. Both weapons are fully loaded. Ball ammo. He ejected a round from each and looked them over in the interior light in the back of the vehicle. Really old ball ammo. U.S. military. But the cartridges seemed to be in good condition. Dom inspected the guns over a little more.
Oh, wow. These are from the war.
What war? Adara asked.
The U.S. invasion. 1989. Jesus, lady, that was a quarter century ago.
The Scion looked more annoyed than embarrassed.
I'm sure they work fine. Lots of security guards in supermarkets and banks use American guns. Again, I was given just hours to accomplish this task. I don't just sit down here waiting to be called on by Tel Aviv to buy illegal weapons.
We understand, said Adara. Her voice was considerably softer and more conciliatory than Dom had made his. There is some synthetic motor oil in the boat. We can clean and lube these tonight. Dom slid everything back into the pack, and he hoisted it on his shoulder. While he did this, the Panamanian woman eyed Adara suspiciously.
I'm sorry, but I have to say, you don't look like Mossad.
Adara just smiled.
And that, Maria, is the key to my success.
They made it back to the hotel before midnight. Dom wanted to grab another drink in the tiny and empty lobby bar, but Adara talked him out of it, insisting they needed to clean the guns and get some sleep before tomorrow's operation. In the room, Adara stripped and lubed the M16 while Dom worked on the Beretta M9. Dom didn't have much experience with this particular pistol, but it broke down and operated similarly to most all of the other semi-autos he shot, both with the FBI and in his clandestine work with the campus. Adara, on the other hand, had been issued an M9 in the Navy, but in Afghanistan she'd carried an M16 not altogether unlike the one she now cleaned. This model in front of her was the A2, and she'd shot the A4, but internally they looked virtually identical. After the weapons were ready for action, Adara excused herself and disappeared into the bathroom for a few minutes. She came out wearing a gray T-shirt with Navy written across the chest and a pair of sweatpants with Virginia in orange running down the left leg. Her short hair was in a ponytail, and she wore eyeglasses, which Dom found extremely appealing. He also stole a few glances at her body as she got ready for bed. Then he went into the bathroom to change. 5 minutes later, Dom came out wearing plain black boxers and a plain white tank top. Adara had all the lights off except for a single lamp by the bed. She said, "I've got an alarm set for 0530.
"Sounds good," said Dom, and he began walking toward his side of the bed.
Adara raised an eyebrow, and Dom noticed the gesture. He smiled confidently. "Don't worry, Sherman. I'm a gentleman." She returned his smile, then said, "Glad to hear it," before grabbing a pillow off the bed and tossing it on the wicker sofa. "I saw a blanket in the closet. I'd shake it for bugs if I were you." Dom stood in the middle of the room for a moment. He looked at the good-looking blonde on the big bed, and then he looked at the uninviting sofa.
"Really?"
Adara nodded.
"Really. Night, Caruso."
Dom grabbed the blanket out of the closet, gave it a few shakes, and headed for the couch as Adara Sherman flipped off the lamp by the bed.
"Night, Sherman."
Adara and Dom headed to the dock at 6:30 a.m., A cool, early morning rain shower kept the streets even emptier than they would have normally been at this time of day. They carried full backpacks and more gear in bags under their arms, but it still took 2 trips to the boat to get everything loaded. Once on board, Dom pulled the pieces of the M16 out of the backpack Maria gave him and assembled the rifle, which he stowed in a large cooler under the row of seats at the boat's stern. Adara was surprised.
"You aren't taking the rifle with you to your hide site?"
"I wish I could.
But with everything else I'm hauling, a 40-inch-long 10-pound M16 is going to be more than I can deal with. I'll just take the pistol. You keep the rifle on board the boat in case you've got to come pick me up in a hurry.
There is another option, she said.
I'm all ears.
I can leave you in the water at the waypoint we decided on, then head around to the other side of the island. I'll find a secluded place to drop anchor. Then I can make my way to you overland with the rifle. It might take me a few hours, but I'll get it done.
Dom shook his head. I appreciate the spirit, Sherman, but I'd rather have you and this boat together at all times. There are a lot of unknowns on this operation, so I'm not giving up the option to run away.
Adara fired the engines of the Mastercraft at 7 a.m. Even though a light rain continued to fall, boat traffic in the channel was picking up. Small cargo vessels running between the islands, ferries, fishing boats, dive boats heading out to fuel up for the day. It seemed to Dom that every third vessel around Cologne Island was already out of its slip and on the water. Adara stood at the helm and piloted the boat with confidence. Once they left the transportation lanes, she pushed the throttle forward, and the two 5.7-liter engines churned up more of the dirty canal water. The stern lowered deeper, and the bow rose as the 25-foot vessel picked up speed. Dom sat on the deck at the stern and donned his scuba gear. Then he checked and rechecked the rest of the equipment he'd be taking onto the island with him. His backpack was fully laden with water and gear, enough to last him 48 hours if necessary, and he'd wrapped all the items inside the waterproof pack in a layer of garbage bags to keep everything dry while diving. It was a 10-minute run across the channel before Adara cut speed and began trolling along Bastamentos Island. There were a few little eco-lodges on the shoreline, but the farther south they traveled, the less development they saw. They approached the mouth of a wide inlet. The water was calm other than the effect of the raindrops on the surface. She consulted with a printout from Eagle View a few times to check the distance to the Venezuelan compound so she would be sure she didn't get any closer than she had planned. When they were close to Caruso's planned ingression point, Adara cut all power. The light rain had picked up to a driving downpour. Adara wore a baseball cap that kept water out of her eyes, but otherwise she was soaked. Dom, on the other hand, was all suited up and ready to go diving, so the rain was inconsequential to him. He said, "Head straight back to the hotel, but be ready to come pick me up at all times. I'll gas up and stay close to the boat. If you call for extraction, I can be back in the area in less than 25 minutes.
Good. I'll check in every other hour by sat phone. If I miss two checks, bring the boat back here and try to raise me on the walkie-talkie. If that doesn't work, I'll have to swim out to you. Whatever happens, I don't want you landing this boat and coming ashore yourself. Are we clear about that?"
"Fine. But if things get dicey and you want to rethink that plan, just let me know."
Dom attached his backpack to a piece of rope tied around his waist, then donned his mask and sat on the port side edge of the boat. He put on his fins, slipped the regulator's second stage in his mouth, and held on to his mask to keep it in place. With a nod to Adara Sherman, he rolled backward. His fins flipped up in the air as he disappeared over the side. Once in the water, he gave Adara an okay signal and let some air out of his vest. Then he disappeared below the surface. Adara waited for a few minutes, then started the boat's engines and turned back for Bocas Town. Dom wore a belt with 25 pounds of lead weights to counter the buoyancy of both his wetsuit and BCD, as well as his watertight bag of gear. With the weights, he descended easily to a depth of 30 feet. There he pumped air into his vest to give himself just enough buoyancy to glide over the sandy and grassy bottom. He swam into the center channel of the inlet so that the bubbles from his regulator would not be visible from shore. With the rain, he felt confident it would be hard to detect a single diver from the surface, but he was alone, with no easy avenue of escape if he was discovered, so he didn't plan on taking any unnecessary chances. He swam to the east, keeping just above the seagrass on the surface of the brackish inlet, using the compass built into his watch to orient his route to the Venezuelan safe house.
The current was with him, and he found himself moving much faster than he'd expected. After only 20 minutes, he chanced a slow ascent to the surface. He was right where he wanted to be, so he went back down, left the center of the channel, and headed to shore. He remained near the bottom all the way to the shore, pushing through tall grasses, spooking fish that kicked up sand, and then negotiating